This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Amy Kaufman is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author. Her multi-award-winning work has been translated into nearly 30 languages and is in development for film and television. Raised in Australia and Ireland, Amy has degrees in literature, law, history, and conflict resolution, and she's currently undertaking a PhD in creative writing. Her series include The Illuminae Files, The Aurora Cycle, The Other Side of the Sky Duology, The Starbound Trilogy, The Unearthed Duology, and The Elementals Trilogy. Her work has taken home multiple Aurealis Awards, an ABIA, a Gold Inky, made multiple best of lists, and been shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards. Amy's latest work is her new solo series, the first of which is called The Isles of the Gods. Amy Kaufman, it's been a long time coming, but I am so excited to welcome you to the First Time Podcast to our Master Series. Thank you for being here.
I'm really excited to be here. I'm a listener and I always, you know, I don't know about you, when I listen to my favorite podcasts, I'm always like, oh, I would really, you know, I would get on with the hosts. I would be great on that show, despite usually knowing very little about the topic. I'm convinced that, you know, the hosts and I would be friends.
Yeah, so, totally. Well, it's very strange because I was just telling you before we started recording that I've been listening to both of your podcasts, which we'll put links to, Amy Kaufman on Writing and Pub Dates, two fabulous podcasts. And so your voice has been in my ear and now it's here and I can see you on the screen and it's just delightful. What I do realize is that you are just 1 week away from launch of your, now, I don't know if I've done the sums correctly. I want to call it your 21st book, your fourth solo title. Is that correct?
It is, I have 21 under contract, but this will be the 19th one coming out.
I mean, it all sounds pretty crazy. Okay.
20 if you count the novella, but yeah.
Okay. It's a bloody lot is what I'm trying to say, Amy Kaufman.
Yeah. So,
Isle of the Gods is coming out next week and we will get to talking about that. But first, as we always do, let's go back. Let's go way back. Okay. In time to the first book you ever have published. I want to know, Amy, what was it? How did you write it? And how did it get published?
Not conventionally is the answer to all of that. So the first book I ever had published was These Broken Stars, which I co-wrote with my friend Megan Spooner, who I still write with today. And it came out at the end of 2013. Okay. And we had been writing fan fiction together for years, and that's how we met, in fan communities. And Meg had this great aspiration to be an author, and she got herself into a program called Odyssey, which is quite like Clarion, for those who know Clarion. It's a, you know, 6-week intensive residential writing workshop, and it's very difficult to get into, you know, thousands of applicants, 16 people do it. And so she quit her job to go, and off she went. And she got home and had to move back in with her parents because, you know, she'd quit her job to go. And, I mean, moving back in with your parents as an adult is challenging, you know, even when everyone's trying real hard, which they all were. And, of course, she also had that thing that I think often happens to people after a residential program or something really intense, where you've just learned a lot of rules. And every time you try to write something, a little voice in your head goes, oh, but don't start a paragraph with that, or, oh, but that's too slow, you know, whatever. And so she came home and she's with her parents and she's not writing. She's trying, but she's not writing. And eventually she said to me, I'm going to have to stop this. I'm going to have to go and get a job. Because her parents had said, if you want to stay here for a little minute and write, then, you know, you're here anyway, so do it. But she was like, I'm going to have to stop, going to have to get a job. And I thought, well, that's going to be the end of you, because she's such an introvert that going into an office all day was going to be killer. You know, she's going to have nothing left in the tank. And so, you know, as she's doing the job hunting process, she finally sits down and writes a chapter of something and sends it to me. It's the first thing that she has sent me since she got back. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, okay, great, you're back. And Meg had been my flatmate here in Australia previously. And so I went to my husband, who was also, I was living with him at the time as well, and said, well, I proposed something to him, and being the chill guy that he is, it was like 3 minutes later, he was like, yeah, that sounds good. So I went back to Meg and said, all right, you've got our spare room for a year. Like, get on a plane, come to Australia, we'll cover you. You're going to write a book, because I know that you will write a book if you come. And she came, and about 3 months later, she'd written a book, and about 4 months later, she had an agent, and about 4.5 months later, she had a book deal. And that was
Oh my Lord.
I know. And in the meantime, Meg and I are still writing together for fun. And
you are
when
a fairy
got...
godmother. I'm just interrupting to say you are a book fairy godmother, Amy Kaufman. Okay, now carry on. You're still writing for fun.
I mean, the thing about Meg is she's my work wife. Like, in the truest sense of the word, her success is my success. Mine is hers. We are both maybe even more thrilled for each other's success than we are for our own.
Yeah.
We've done everything together. But it was only when she got that book deal that we both kind of looked at each other and went, oh, so can we write at a publishable level? Oh, that's interesting. We didn't know that, because we'd been writing for many, many years, but just never trying to get published. And she and I, about this time, we'd had to drift out of one of the fan fiction communities we were in, just because it was US-based, and I finally got a job at like the age of 26. I had exited university and gained employment, much to my dismay. And that meant I wasn't around in Aussie mornings, US evenings. So I wasn't participating in the community. And so Meg and I were like, oh, well, let's just write our own thing. And then for whatever reason, one of us said, oh, let's just make it original. And we still didn't think we were writing a book. We were just writing a story to entertain each other, because I think we were both a little concerned that maybe the friendship would start to drift because I wasn't in this online community with her every day. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, well, what do we both like? And the answer was space and shipwreck. So we were like, let's do a shipwreck in space. And we thought, oh, what we'll do is we'll crash one life pod and we'll just sort of write little back and forth fiction. Like, I write one character, you write the other, you know, and role play it out about the first escape pod. And then when we get bored of that, we'll write the second escape pod and the third, and then maybe they can all meet in the end. And we never got past the first escape pod because we were having so much fun. And it was when Meg sold her book that we thought, oh, could this be a story? Is that wild? So we turned, you know, 50 pages of it into writing and sent it to her agency, who were like, yes, that is a book. Please write the rest now. Amy, would you like to be our client? And so we wrote the rest, and over about 6 months, and it went to auction in the States in November of 2011. And it wasn't that we hadn't done the many, many hard yards beforehand. We just hadn't done them writing books that we then submitted and didn't sell.
Okay. So many questions just from that. It's
yeah,
such
I know.
A great
that
story.
That was a long answer.
It's amazing. It's amazing. One of the things was that you said Megan wanted to be an author, which I heard in your implication that you didn't want to be. So had there been a dream that you wanted to be an author, or you were just happy playing in writing space and didn't see it as moving on to being an author?
I don't think that I knew that you could be an author. Mm. I think I have a vivid memory of being in year eight and being chosen to go to Melbourne Writers Festival. And I saw Isabel Carmody and Melina Marchetta speak. And that was the first time I knew that authors were like real human beings, as opposed to sort of, you know, all dead or mystical beasts that all lived on Author Island. And that was the first inkling I had. And in year 11, we did careers testing, and I actually got author as one of my options. And I vividly remember thinking, imagine if that was a job. They're just moving on.
Imagine if it was a real one.
Right. But I mean, I think the thing is, in some areas of my life, I'm a great risk taker. In others, I'm not. And for me, I wanted to get a job that I felt secure in. That was important to me. You know, I was a kid of the 90s. I, you know, saw my parents go through the recession. And I think, like a lot of kids in my age bracket, I was very aware that, you know, being financially precarious is a dangerous thing. Mm. And that, you know, if you want to be safe, you have to make yourself
safe. 9 to 5. You have to have right. a job, a grown-up job.
Yeah.
That's not right. an author.
No, exactly. I knew that much I knew. And so it just sort of hadn't occurred to me that I might try it. I wouldn't have had the faintest idea how. I just loved writing for writing's sake and just enjoyed it so much. And it was only when Meg got published that I was like, oh, well, maybe it is achievable. I still didn't think of it as a career. I just thought maybe I could publish a book and also have my job. So, yeah.
Let's talk about that transition, because I know that now you are a full-time writer. This is over a 10-year period, obviously. How long did you manage that real grown-up job? And I want to talk about that real grown-up job, because you talk about it on the podcast and it's very interesting. But how long did you manage that and the writing at the same time before you shifted into going, okay, I can be a full-time writer in whatever way that looked like to you?
Let me think. So we sold Broken Stars in November 2011. I remember because it was Thanksgiving and the editors were literally putting in bids from the airport before getting on their planes to go home for Thanksgiving. And it was like they would get off the plane and find out who got the book, I guess. And so I would say for me, that's when I began writing, you know, with a deadline, as opposed to prior to that, I had been writing and having a day job, but there was no actual deadline. So therefore, you know, less pressure. I then essentially wrote full time and worked full time through to Thanksgiving, so November 2013, which was about a month before Broken Stars came out, and that was when we sold Illuminae. And that was when I now had six books under contract, none of which had come out yet, and it was for enough money that I thought, okay, this will cover me for a few years. So that was when I began to think about it. It was like November 2013, and I left my job in January 2014, so a few months later. And one of the factors for me in leaving it was that I had 18 months left on my professional certification, and so I thought, well, I'll give it a year, and if it's not working, I'll have 6 months to get my CPD hours up and come back in. And I also worked in a small field where I had standing job offers. So I knew that in the event I needed to come back, within a few months I would be able to find something that I could come back into. So it was a very conservative approach. And I will say, because I think it's important to be honest about this stuff, one of the real deciding factors was that the August before I quit in January, the August beforehand, I got really sick, and it was because I was overworking. I got a very simple UTI that turned into a full-blown kidney infection and me in hospital for nearly 2 weeks.
Oh, God. Nightmare.
It was so painful. Having now given birth to a human child, I can confirm on par, easily on par. Yeah. And I remember lying in the hospital bed and the doctor saying to my husband, because I was in no state to answer questions, they weren't being gentlemen talking over me, oh, this has just escalated really quickly. Has she had any stress in her life lately? And my husband just started laughing uncontrollably, like he didn't even know where to start.
You wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
Because that stress, okay, let's just unpack that a little. In 2 years, you go from, you know, writing kind of on the side with mate to having six book contracts with two different co-authors. What happens in that 2 years, Amy? Are you just like, do you just have kind of stories sprouting out of you like mushrooms? Are you putting feelers out to work with other people? Are the agents saying to you, we want more of you, Kaufman, give us more? What's happening in that time?
Look, my agents are great. They're always very mindful of our welfare. So they're never asking for more. They see their job as we tell them what we're trying to achieve and they try to make it happen, which I really love about my agency. They're never pushy, but they're always supportive. I think I was just, I really felt like I wanted to seize the day. I loved these books that I had coming out with Meg. I felt really confident about them. And working with Jay happened really by accident. We got to know each other because I was trying to fill out my US tax forms and I was like it was Kafka-esque, these things. I could not, like I was sitting there thinking to myself, I'm in possession of a law degree and I cannot understand this form. And I complained to it about a friend at work and he went, would you believe you're the second person to complain to me about that this week? I know a guy. And so we dedicated Illuminae to him. He put me in touch with Jay and I just cold emailed Jay and was like, you don't know me, but I'm trying to figure out this tax form and I will come to wherever you are in Melbourne and buy you breakfast if you will just show me what boxes to tick. And he's notoriously terrible at email, but he saw that one and was like, oh, I cannot leave someone in pain because I know the pain of this form. And so we just started having breakfast like once a month because we were both about to debut and we were like, we didn't know anyone else in Melbourne who wrote yet. So we just made friends that way. And yeah.
When did you decide, you and Jay, and I will point our listeners to the interview that I heard you do with each other on the Garrett, which was the first time that I was like, wow, I have to talk to these people. When did you decide that you should write together? When did you start kicking around writing ideas?
Let me think. It was quite soon after we met, like maybe a year after we met, I think. Yeah, I would say it was a year after we met because we named Squad 312 in our book after March 2012, which is when we met.
I love this so much.
In, you know, by 2013, we had sold Illuminae. But I think it was probably about April 2013, so about a year later, I bowled up to breakfast one day and told him I had had this anxiety dream overnight, you know, like the ones where, you know, you show up and you didn't remember there was a test today and it's in German and whatever. And I dreamed that he and I were co-writing a novel because I think I'd been talking about co-writing the night before and I knew I was going to see him and it all collided in my brain. But the anxiety dream was that I couldn't remember what the book was about. And so I spent the whole dream sort of fishing, you know, being like, so how would you describe our book? And the only thing I remembered about it was that it was in emails. And so, you know, he laughed at me, but we both kind of went, ha ha ha, though wait. And we just started batting around for fun, you know, what would it be? Why would it be in emails? What kind of book would that turn into? And that became Illuminae. But certainly, you know, we didn't go out hunting for it. The idea just showed up and forced its way in.
Yeah, there's two things that I want to unpack there. The first one is that you are now find yourself in two co-authoring relationships. And I want to know, did you all sit down and have dinner together and go, okay, when do we get Amy's time and attention and energy? You know, like how do you arrange something like that? Because it's quite an intense, I imagine, quite an intense working relationship with both people that you're co-authoring with there. How did that all work out?
Yeah, it took a lot of like me being really thoughtful. And I'm like one of my strengths is project management. And I brought a lot of that to this to make sure that I was not in a position where two things were falling due on two different books at the same time, because it was very, very important to me that neither co-author felt like they were second fiddle and that neither co-author be second fiddle. So I communicated just constantly with both of them about, you know, I'm going to have these edits coming in, so I'm going to go quiet. So I'm doing this and this now so I can give it to you and then it'll be yours for a month while I, you know, do X, Y, Z. And so, you know, that worked well. I remember wondering if Meg and Jay were going to like each other and, you know, wondering if, you know, because I mean, I like them both very much and they're both lovely people, but thinking, I don't know, maybe there'll just be some sort of weird tension because they're both like, oh, you're the other one that she does this with. And one time we were all going to be in New York at the same time. And I was like, let's all go out to dinner. And then I can't remember how I ended up not being there. I think my flight got delayed or something. And so ended up being the two of them plus another couple of local authors. And I thought, well, this is going to go one of two ways. And all I can do is sit back and find out. And I heard nothing from them all night. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what's happening? You know, they're both, you know, despite being great public speakers, they're both sort of introverts and thinking they're going to, you know, maybe they're just keeping it to themselves if they're not having a good time. And then the drunk text started at about 11 and they continued until about 3 a.m. at which point my understanding is they were out at karaoke together.
So it worked well.
And yeah, when I finally got to Meg the next morning, she had literally no voice and she was like, that man is the devil. I like him very much. So yeah, they're just very, very similar in personality. And they, you know, they mightn't present outwardly that way, but they're very similar. And I think they both recognized themselves in the other one and liked the other one.
Do you have the same method in practical kind of logistic terms of working with each other?
Yeah, and when I then subsequently started co-authoring on my middle grade with Ryan Groudon, Ryan was like, well, you've done this a lot, tell me your method, and I did. And so now it's with all three. And, yeah, it's very similar because what works, works, I guess. Mm-hmm. And for us, that's, you know, outlining a section together, emailing chapters back and forth, critiquing as we go. It's, you know, Meg and I had naturally happened across that. And so I suggested to Jay, this might be a good way to do it because it's worked for me so far. And yeah, I think probably because he and Meg are very similar, he took to it instantly.
Now, you said the word that you didn't want anyone to feel like they were second fiddle. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask if you, solo writer Amy Kaufman, mm-hmm. ever felt second fiddle. When did you realize that you wanted to start doing your own solo work, and how did that come about?
I mean, I always knew that I would, but I was so deeply in love with the stories that I was telling with my friends that I didn't feel oppressed to do it straight away. I'm much more social than the average writer, I think. And I love collaborating on anything and everything in all parts of my life. I'm always finding ways to collaborate because I love that experience of, you know, you plus me equals something better than we could do on our own. And, you know, that was certainly there in my previous career as well. It's always been a through line through my life. And I mean, my first solo series was a middle grade series, and it came about because an editor who I had absolutely loved working with on Broken Stars had shifted publishers and had room in her slate for a middle grade fantasy, and had remembered that I loved middle grade and I had always said that I wanted to write it one day. And she came and asked me if I would consider giving it a go for her. And so that kind of nudged me into it. And, you know, of course I thought, oh my goodness, you know, what if it turns out I can't write at all and I've been entirely propped up by these wonderful, talented people that I've, you know, definitely attached myself to like a leech? What if I can't do anything? But, you know, then I did it and it was fine. And I could. But I think that the Isles of the Gods took so long to come because for whatever reason, something I don't know that I could dig out the reasoning behind it, I wanted it to be my first solo YA. I turned down other opportunities. I've been approached over the years for novelizations of films and other IPs, and I said no to them because I wanted my first solo YA to be this book. And I wasn't ready yet. Until I finally started working on it in lockdowns, I wasn't good enough yet. And so I think that also held me off.
That's really interesting. I wanted to ask because I've heard you describe Isle of the Gods as the most favorite thing you've ever written. Is it partly because it's been a labor of love for so long, Amy?
Yeah, I'm sure that it is. I had an absolutely clear vision in 2013 of what I wanted it to be, and I wasn't willing to compromise on that. And that meant every few years I'd come back and have another peck and be like, oh, not there yet. And eventually I was ready. Eventually I found it. And it's so rewarding to have made it into what I wanted to be.
And so rewarding to read, might I say. I absolutely flew through it. It's very exciting. And
thank you.
Obviously, I will not ask about spoilers about book two, but I'm desperate. I'm like, come on, Amy, move a place in your slate. I want to talk about that project management because the idea that you not only have so many creative projects going on in your brain, but also quite complex ones, I imagine, when you're working in series and sequels and things like that. How do you hold space for each of those different projects, and how do you begin working on them?
Look, I used to find it easier than I do now. And I think there are a lot of things that people say about having children that I used to think were terribly sexist and insulting, and I've now had to acknowledge some degree of truth about. I think that's a phrase that a lot of us go through.
Yeah, it sure is.
But, you know, I used to be able to juggle three books at a time, and I would just pick the one up each day that I was working on and be like, well, this is what I'm working on now. I'd say I can now juggle two at a time, but I don't enjoy doing that. And so I now structure my writing in such a way that I can do good long blitzes on individual books. Like, you know, as we speak, I am in edits for, not in edits, I'm drafting, sorry, the sequel to The Isles of the Gods, because I'm behind because long COVID. But then when I finish that, I will move on to the next book that Meg and I have contracted, which we're past the midpoint on that book, but she has very kindly paused it because Isles' sequel needs doing quickly.
Yeah.
But, you know, a friend very wisely said to me, well, you know, your child's taking up at least one of those slots now. And I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, this is a kid that was 10 years in the making and took an army of medical professionals to achieve. And, you know, we certainly, she's it. We won't walk this path again. So I want to slow down and enjoy that and be in it with her. And that means that I am writing slower, and that's fine by me.
I've been really taken and impressed by a couple of different things that I've seen you do and talk about. One of them, I noticed just in when we were emailing back and forth that you've got a footer on your email saying that you normally respond to emails on Wednesdays because other time is for writing. And I've also seen you talk in interviews about having locked out kind of morning time for writing. You also said somewhere that at one point in your professional career, in mediation, that a boss sent you on a very good time management course. Can you give us some of your key findings at how to manage your time so well? Because it's clear that you do, even with the things that you're saying about different pressures on it now.
It's something I have thought a lot about because it is a learned skill. I mean, I think, you know, modesty aside, it's definitely a strength of mine, but it is a strength because I have learned it, not because I am an organized person. In fact, my boss sent me on that course because I was so chronically disorganized. And, you know, when I was mediating, there were timelines that were set in stone, like you have to request information from the parties 2 weeks beforehand. And I just wasn't doing it because everything was falling through the cracks. And I was, you know, I had this meeting with him where I said, this isn't working. When I get the parties in the room, I can settle anything. It's, you know, I'm good at this. But if we don't have the material because I didn't get onto it, then it's not going to work. I don't need a lunchtime seminar. I need help. And he said, I'm so pleased to hear you say that. And he sent me off to the Australian Institute of Management for like a full process design and time management course, which was great. And the big things that I took out of it, and since then, I think my top three reads on this subject, for what it's worth, for those who are hearing this and being like, yes, I need to make this
like transformation. Like me, look at my face.
Deep Work by Cal Newport, of which I'm a huge fan. Essentialism by Greg McKeown, which is, you know, Deep Work speaks to creating time to focus. Essentialism speaks to not being sidetracked by 1,000 small things that feel important. And the other one is Rest by Alex Soo-Jung Kim Pang, which, you know, the hint is in the name. It talks about the importance of rest, not just because you perform better when you rest, but also because like life's better when you rest. And all of that kind of culminated for me in reading Like the Rest of the World, 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. So for me, time management is about, I've got a spreadsheet that covers my whole year, and I start with when everything is due, and then I break it into pieces and work my way backwards and plot it into a calendar that also holds all of my travel and all of my big commitments, because there is no point saying I'm going to write 30,000 words in a month when I've got three festivals. I will not do that. And so I block in everything that's immovable. Then I block in my writing time around it and my family time around it, because those are the two highest priorities. And then I have a list of my other stuff. I block in, you know, this is when I'll do my podcast season. You know, this is when I'll try and, you know, there's a, I have a course that I'm developing at the moment that I'd like to launch later this year, but writing it has to fit around, you know, the family time and the writing time.
Is it on managing your time as an author? Because can I please sign up now?
It is on, look, that is actually one of the components. It is going to be on living a sustainable and deliberate and joyful creative life.
Oh my gosh. And I put my name at the top of the spreadsheet, please, Amy Kaufman. I'm in.
Time management is a part of that, but it is a combination of planning and discipline. So I start with the calendar. I block in, you know, all of the big rocks that are not going to move when I plow my field, or whatever metaphor we want to use, you know, the travel, the you know, school holidays, the whatever. And then I block in my writing, I block in my family commitments. So I only just worked out maybe a few months ago that I'm a bit weird in this respect. I was talking about time management with my writers group, and I shared a screenshot of my weekly diary on our Slack. And it turns out that I do something that others don't do, which I guess thought was more normal than it is, which is I block out everything in my diary. So in my diary, I have standing appointments every week. So I have all of my writing time blocked in every week, and I have my family time. So that's, you know, a half day with my husband, a half day with my kid. You know, I have going for a walk every day blocked out. I have all of the stuff that has to happen as far as I'm concerned, because that then shows me how much time I have left. And so I don't end up saying to people, yeah, I'll do that, because I can look at the diary and be like, well, actually, that whole week is full. And I can drag appointments around if I want, you know, like, for instance, I'm talking to you today and my book comes out next week. So I decided to do a bunch of publicity requests this morning. And when we finish, then I'll write, which is not when I would usually do it. But I drag things around. And if I'm going to delete them, it means I really know that's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, okay, so that's a 3-hour block of writing that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? What are the implications of that going to be?
This just is so smart, and it's kind of blowing my brain. How are you on saying no, and how have you got better at it over time?
Yeah, I've gotten much better at it over time. You know, it's such a cliche, but I do apply the would I want to do it if it was tomorrow? And if the answer is no, then I'm not going to want to do it later. And I have also gotten much better at getting my sweet little brain to understand that it is not the hour event. It is the travel to, it is the travel from, it is the wind down time. And so, you know, I've started, you know, when they're the type of events that I'm paid for, I've set my rate at a point that compensates me for what it takes for me to do it. And if that's more than people want to pay, that's totally fine. But it means that I feel, if I do take the engagement, I feel good about it, and I feel really motivated to make sure it's wonderful for everyone who's at it. But I do say no a lot as well. Yeah.
You strike me as someone who is a really engaged, kind of what we call on the podcast, a good industry citizen. You're often doing launches for people. Your name comes up as someone who mentors and supports. You're mentioned by people when they talk about writers groups. How do you manage what I imagine are an ever increasing number of requests on your time from other writers in terms of endorsements, support, advice, mentoring? How do you manage that? Because it's a little bit different, I know, from experience from the kind of paid gigs when other people are asking you those things.
Oh, yeah, I find that much harder because I place such a premium on being, yeah, let's say a good industry citizen. I think you absolutely have to send the elevator back down every chance you can. And one of the challenges I find with it actually is that so much of it is unseen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've spent, you know, days, if not weeks of my time over the last 6 months, you know, working with, you know, writers from various diverse backgrounds, either to help them develop work or to help them advocate for themselves or to advocate for them when they ended up in situations that were far from ideal. And on one hand, you don't want to talk about it in public because you don't want them to feel like they have to thank you in public, and mm-hmm. because they don't. And B, you don't want to look like you're trying to get a cookie from anyone.
Right.
But on the other hand, I do know that to some degree, making that I am doing it visible encourages other people to do it as well and creates a norm within the industry, because I think, you know, anyone who's published needs to think about how they got there. And if people helped them, then they need to be doing the same. And I certainly have a vivid memory of not knowing things and not knowing who to ask. And, you know, I am particularly confident and particularly outgoing and particularly unafraid of marching up to people and saying, I don't know this, would you mind telling me? But a lot of people aren't like that, and a lot of writers aren't like that. So I overextend myself is the short answer. And if I can't help someone, I will try to pass them to someone who can. And that might be because that other person is better qualified, or it might be because I'm just slammed and I know that I won't be able to be reliable, which is unacceptable if you've said you're going to help someone. So I think most people who are friends with me have at some point had someone pass to, you know, I'll always ask first, but have had someone pass to them with, could you give this person a bit of advice? Could you help this person out? But I think also we're getting better and better resources available, which means that more and more you're able to point someone to something that's in the public domain, but save yourself for those really sticky things that actually need a bit of discreet assistance.
That's a really great answer and so many important things that you bring up. When you're talking about that time management, how do you manage those kinds of requests that must come into you, by members of the writing community and also via the reading community on your social media, via your website? What kind of a block do you call that, Amy, in your working week?
Yeah, well, I mean, so look, I've on social media, I've really pulled back to just Instagram, and I have a policy that I rarely engage with my DMs there because it's not a very efficient use of time to answer people's questions one by one. And, you know, if enough people are wondering about something, I will talk about it publicly. But I'll be on, I mean, at risk of sounding a little bit mean, most of the questions I'm getting in my DMs are things that people could have Googled in the time that they have taken to DM me. And so I feel okay about leaving them to figure it out.
I'm going to interrupt just to make sure that our listeners know that you have 44,000 or something like that followers on Instagram. So I'm just trying to give people a bit of a sense of the types and numbers of DMs that you might be getting as well.
I mean, dozens a day, and in busy times, sometimes hundreds. Yep. So, you know, you literally, if you sat there and answered every single one of them for 30 seconds, that would be hours a day. So not an option. I try to cast my eye over them when I can, but I'm also mindful that, you know, I have full contact information on my website. So it's not like they don't have a way to get to me if they actually really need to get to me.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, I lump that stuff in with my admin. So Wednesday is my admin day, and I don't aim to write on Wednesdays, and, you know, I'll set aside however much time I need. That said, you know, I had a couple of months ago, I had a writer come to me in distress, and that was 2 days of my time that we just spent dealing with that. And I mean, you know, priorities, right? Like sometimes we stop what we're doing to help someone, as we hope that I feel like I'm making myself sound like a saint here. I'm really not.
No. Yeah, it makes
very much just a human being, but
it makes sense.
Yeah.
You mentioned about your writer's group, and I know that this is a really important, and you're talking about collaboration. This is really important. Your writer's group obviously has Slack, which is incredible to me. Like, you've moved past just the WhatsApp. This is amazing. How does your writer's group work with you and for you, and what does it bring to you, Amy?
So I dedicated the Isles of the Gods to my writer's group.
I did see that.
They kept me afloat. There's a line in the Isles of the Gods where I think Sally says to Leander something like, I'm going to get you there if I have to sail you there myself. And they absolutely sailed me there themselves through lockdown. They originally were a group of friends that I made because I decided that I needed writer friends. I didn't know anyone. And so I found a couple of them on Twitter back. I mean, we're talking in like, I don't know, 2011, 2012 maybe. And then a few more who I just saw. And I make friends like a kindergartner. I mean, I feel like the first time I remember interacting with you, Kate, was me coming out of the blue and being like, I just wanted to let you know I saw you at that library event and your lipstick was incredible and I bought some and I'm wearing my first ever bright lip because of you.
Yes.
So, you know, but that's how I make friends. So a few of them were just me pointing and being like, hey, I think we're going to be great friends. Mm. And, you know, and I've never made a bad call on that front. And so, you know, we started going on retreat together, and then after one of the retreats we decided to start a Slack because Slack had sort of come into the group consciousness. And through lockdown, every single day we would wake up, we still do it most days, and we would get on the little accountability channel and we'd say, here's good morning everyone, how are we all doing, here's what I'm going to do today. And then at the end of the day, we'd all report in on what we actually did. And we also had little channels for, you know, asking publishing questions and talking about non-writing stuff and helping each other with research and so on. And we had one that we kept all of the COVID talk to just one channel, so you could just mute it. You know, as we all did during lockdown, you're having one of those moments where you're like, I actually just don't even want to hear about this.
Don't want to hear the word anymore.
Just yep, you could just corral that off. And, you know, we still, it's what I do first thing every morning. I get up and I say good morning to my gang and tell them what I'm going to try and do today. And, you know, someone will chip in with like, oh, that sounds like a big one. Make sure you get lunch. And, you know, it's just, it's a gorgeous, loving, supportive group. And yes, I often will critique and be critiqued by the group, but that is not even the most important part of it.
That's so interesting. We're going to talk about writers groups soon on the podcast on an awkward convo, because we know that people have them for so many different reasons, sometimes for that sharing of work and critiquing, sometimes for those kind of publishing questions, and sometimes just for the accountability, like I'm doing this, I'm never going to share it with you, but this is what I'm doing. So it's interesting to see that in your group you combine all of those things together.
We do, and we all, I think, drift in and out of taking what we need from it at particular times. So, you know, if someone's got a pitch that they've pulled together, they'll pop it up and be like, anyone got 10 minutes to look at this? And whoever's free will. And sometimes we're just, you know, chatting about what's on the front page of the paper or whatever. But otherwise, as a writer, you can spend the whole day at home by yourself. Mm. And that little bit of company, that little bit of, you know, someone telling a silly joke, or being able to even just pop on and be like, okay, today's not going very well, I'm going to regroup, and someone being like, okay, you can do it, let me help you regroup, is invaluable.
Mm. What I know, I think I know about that writers group is that you are all writers of YA and middle grade fiction. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Some of us also have adult projects, but everyone writes either YA or middle grade.
And I know also that you're all very good at it. And what I want to ask you, for those of our listeners who might be just stepping into writing for those YA and middle grade audiences, some of your key principles of getting that right, because it's something that you really have to get right. And I know in Isle of the Gods, and even in, I've been listening to the audiobook of Illuminae, which is extraordinary. And
a whole other thing, yeah.
Wow, such a whole other thing. But just really feeling the extraordinary complex weight of some of the things that happen, some of the events, some of the violence, and you just hold it and do it so well. And I know that's something that probably people are scared about. What do I write about? What do YA and middle grade audiences handle? So can you give us the kind of Amy Kaufman key ideas about writing well for YA and middle grade?
I mean, yeah, who knows? This is one version, I guess. But the unbreakable rule for me is don't talk down. Mm. They are not stupid. They just have less life experience than you. And beyond that, I'm one of those weirdos that has memories going all the way back to the age of two. Mm. And so I vividly remember how ardently I felt about things as a kid and as a teenager. And so I think that it's important to introduce that strength of feeling into the book, to remember that, you know, remember when you were at high school and things were really, really all or nothing. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if you want to be writing YA, you've got to embrace that. I think that when you write YA and middle grade, you don't write to deliver a message. Mm. You write to ask a question. And it's, I mean, I don't always know what the question is at the start of the book, but I usually figure it out by the end. And it's usually a question I'm currently asking myself, which is why it's in the book. I think that you trust them with complexity. Mm. Little kids can name 72 species of dinosaur. They can handle your complex plot, frankly, better than adults can a lot of the time. I think that for me, YA is the literature of transformation. It is the literature of figuring out who you are and who you want to be and how you make that happen. And I think that's why so many of us adults go back to it time after time, because, you know, first date after your divorce, first day at school, first day at school pickup, you know, we're always walking into new worlds and building ourselves in those worlds. Mm. But I think it's particularly in YA, you know, that transformation element is really important. Mm. And I think if there's one other unbreakable rule, it's don't be boring. And it, you know, it sounds glib or throwaway, but they're not a forgiving audience. Mm. And you cannot get away with, you know, three pages of a raindrop slowly going down a window pane as a metaphor for divorce, which is not a specific example, not a jab at anyone, but you know, you've got to, and I think that people sometimes think, oh, so that means you can't go deep. It's like, no. You just have to be really good. You have to handle those deep things in a way that's really engaging rather than just deciding that you're going to slow down and that everyone's going to have to come with you. And I mean, if that sounds like I'm having a crack at adult, I'm not. I'm writing adult right now and, you know, enjoying it very much. But I think, yeah, they really hold you accountable. So you can't talk down. You can't be boring. You've got to absolutely trust them with complexity. And, you know, that complexity is why I'm publishing Isles a decade after I started writing it. It's an enormously complex book. You've got 5 POV characters, all of whom come from different sort of classes and backgrounds. You've got 2 different countries with their own cultures. You've got a pantheon of gods. You've got a magic system. And you've got to jump on board with all of that. Oh, you've got a mix of magic and technology. So much you have to jump on board with. And I have to find a way to get you on board with it without giant info dumps and without slowing down. Mm. And weaving all of that together is hard. So it took me a while.
Well, you do it so magically as a reader. And what I love, and I will point our listeners in the direction of specific episodes in both your Pub Dates podcast and also in Amy Kaufman on Writing, where you talk about things like drawing the maps or creating the maps and world building and building characters and writing romance and things like that. But you mentioned there about how you want your books to ask a question. And what struck me when I was listening to some of your exercises and the way that you work things through is that you do kind of build these worlds by asking yourself just a series of questions over and over again, because they are so complex, Amy, like incredibly complex. So can you just tell us a little bit about how you go about building that world, how you bring in the politics, where you get your, are you getting your inspiration from historical things, from images, from contemporary happenings, from kind of all of the above? How do you go about building those worlds to such a degree of complexity?
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because I never think my worlds are that complex, but it's because I have walked into them very slowly and got to know them piece by piece by piece. But I mean, the answer is all of the above, in that I take a very sort of braided approach. The world will usually be the first thing that comes, just some element of it. So, you know, for instance, with the Isles of the Gods, I found out, and I mean, maybe this isn't as surprising to everyone else as me, I don't know, but I was surprised that there were tall ships, like, you know, like the ones with big masts and lots of sails. They were still carrying cargo in our world in the 1920s. And I would have thought that the year they ended doing that would have started with an 18, but no, that between the world wars, they were still carrying cargoes. And I found this incredible photographer, an Australian actually, called Alan Villiers, who had been a sailor in his youth. And when he realized that the last of these tall ships, which were called wind jammers, were going, you know, were slowly phasing out, he got himself on board a couple and took photos. And these photos, like if you were to Photoshop the people out and put them into, you know, contemporary photos, you wouldn't even have to change their clothes. They just look like they're us, but they're on a tall ship. Wow. And I was like, well, that's cool. That's something, this old and new clash. And from there, I started thinking, what would have kept those ships sailing? And my immediate thought, because I'm, you know, a spec fic nerd, was, well, if you had magic that could make the weather more reliable, because that was what ultimately phased them out, was, you know, what if there's no wind? And so I thought, well, if you had wind magicians, that would help. And so that was enough to start the world. And then I hopped over to character and was like, okay, so who's an interesting character in this book? By which we mean, you know, who has room to grow and to learn and to change and to suffer pain and to affect the world around them? And I was like, well, it's a girl who, you know, is on one of these ships. So she's at the crux of this change. And is she a magician? That's less interesting. That's less room to grow and change and move. What if she's meant to be a magician, but she's not? And okay, what could impact her? And so I, you know, jumped back to the world and came up with a few more details, jumped back to her and, you know, created some characters to start sailing with her. And I jumped back and forth. And so the characters are informed by what I know of the world, but then the world expands to meet the needs of the characters.
And are you doing this on index cards, on a whiteboard, in a notes document?
A little bit in my head. Yeah, a little bit in my brain on long walks. And then usually just in an exercise book, which at some point during the process I will lose repeatedly. I'm just not.
Just to raise the stakes.
I mean, look, I feel like, I don't know, I'm always slightly awkward on podcasts because on one hand you're literally being asked for your opinion, but on the other hand at some point you start to think, God, I'm just giving a lot of opinions here. What do I know?
Give us your opinion.
But, you know, yeah, this is definitely a do as I say, not as I do. Like, don't write it all in a notebook. That's a terrible idea. But for me, handwriting is really important. It unlocks something for me that typing doesn't. Mm. So I often go to handwriting.
I love that. Okay. I knew that we would start running out of time. So I've got a couple more questions before I can let you go. One of them is about the marketing and publicity world. You said something really interesting in the lead up to, in the introduction to your newsletter, Finding North, which is terrific. You said the book world is so incredibly unpredictable right now. The old ways of marketing aren't working as they once did, and nobody's figured out new ones yet.
Mm.
You do merch, you do pre-order things, you have amazing images and art that comes along with your work. I know that's partly because of the genre and the market that you're writing into, but can you just tell us a little bit about what's changing at the moment and how you're navigating your way through this with Isle of the Gods?
I mean, I don't know how much I can tell you about how I'm navigating my way through it, because I've never seen publishing in a greater state of flux, and I don't think anyone's worked out how to navigate it yet. I don't feel like I have. It's hard to say what's going on at the moment. I think it is a combination of maybe three things. One, during the pandemic, a lot of chains got broken. So, for instance, I'm not touring in the US for this book, which I've always done before. And part of that is because I am hearing from authors in the US that attendance is way, way, way down. Like, we're talking authors who used to get 100 people at every event are getting like 20, and they're excited if it's 40.
Yeah, wow.
People are not coming. And it's we think it's because a lot of people aged out or lost the habit during COVID, and the new generation didn't come in because the events weren't happening. So we think that's a part of it. And COVID sort of broke a lot of chains in a lot of other ways as well. A lot of us, you know, including I'm sure a lot of your listeners, sort of stopped reading a bit during COVID because your brain just wasn't in, you know, or read different things or, you know, whatever. So I think that's one part of it. I think another part of it is cost of living at the moment. I think that both because people are having to tighten their belts and also because they are worried about having to tighten their belts, even if they don't. They're worried that it's coming for them soon. So people are buying less and they're pre-ordering less. And, you know, like the COVID thing, that's not really something we can circumnavigate. I don't actually want to talk someone into buying my book if they financially shouldn't do that. Yeah. And then I think the third thing is TikTok, that it has really shifted, in YA at least, really shifted book buying culture. Mm-hmm. The pre-order culture, I think, is fading out. And people are more likely to buy a book in the weeks after publication. They're more likely to wait and hear what people think about it and sort of, you know, hear from their friends. There's less of that got to have in the first week, and more of the, I'll wait till I know what it's like, which is fine. You know, it's not necessarily fewer overall sales, but it's an industry, particularly, and I'm thinking more of the US here because we don't have those first week bestseller lists here in Australia. But, you know, in the US, it used to be very based around first week. And so everyone's having to sort of shift their measures of success, which is interesting and stressful. And of course, the other thing about book talk, because I think you really can't overstate how much it's influencing book buying patterns in the States at the moment, is a lot of books that take off on it are backlist and are paperbacks. Because in the US, a paperback is $9.99. So, you know, and a hardcover is $19.99. So $9.99 is going to win, right? So I think working out how to get recommendations out when it's a very reader-driven space. It's not a space that authors and publishers can really go into and sell. So I think everyone's sort of trying to work out. I mean, this is me being very frank, and perhaps franker than I should about all of this.
I love the frankness.
I think, you know, this is the conversation that I am having over and over with veterans behind the scenes. And yep. I think, you know, like maybe it's too frank, but also in that spirit of, you know, we were talking about before, sending the elevator back down. I think there's probably a lot of newer writers who are like, what's going on? I'm doing what I got told to do and it's not working. Not working. Is that just me? And like the answer is no, it's just a very strange time.
Amy, what's your kind of general approach to how much you expect your publisher to do? And I know, you know, we're talking someone who's got a lot of books out in the world with a traditional publisher, so listeners should take that with a grain of salt, but how much you're expecting your publisher to do and how much you personally do in terms of the energy and the effort and the things that you'll put out during promotional time for your books.
I think that people often see things I do and they think they're coming from my publishers and think, oh, she gets so much. Gee, I wish I got that much. And I'm like, some of it's me, you guys. I try to work with my publishers in a way that's complementary because there are things they can do that I can't. You know, the people that they're facing toward are booksellers and librarians and yes, readers, but also other big segments of the book buying market who I don't have direct contact with. And what I have and what I've always worked really hard to have is this very personal relationship with my readers because I'm under no illusion and I don't ever want to forget that I owe my whole career to my readers. I think, you know, anyone who's been to one of my events, it almost certainly started with me thanking everyone for coming and telling them, you are why I do this. You are why I get to write books. You are why I have this dream job of mine and I love it. And thank you for showing up. And so I think I try less to do, I guess, marketing and more to do building a relationship with my readers that is ongoing. And many of them have been with me for a decade. You know, I see their social media handles and I know who they are because they were around for Broken Stars. And, you know, I do that through pub dates, through being just really frank and being me and being honest about things. I do it in my newsletter. I'm very honest in my newsletter about, you know, where I'm at and what's going on. And I try to do it by, you know, even in my Insta stories, just sort of chatting about what's going on for me that day. Because, you know, I mean, I guess an example of that is I lost my sweet, sweet 16 and a half year old dog last week. And, you know, Oh yeah, Jackie was my ride or die for 15 years. I've barely been a grown up without him. But one thing that was really lovely was, you know, he's got his own little highlight on my Insta profile, and my readers have known Jack for you know, the decade that I've been publishing. They got to see Jack, you know, when I was pregnant and he was obsessed with my bump. He didn't know what it was, but he was super into it. Yeah. They've seen him stealing bread. They've seen him crawling under my desk. And you know, you don't want to share every single part of your life with a large number of people you don't know, because not all of them are friendly. And that's certainly, I've had my share of experiences with that. But I value my readers so much, and I don't want there to be a divide where on one hand I am the creator and I pass unto them my gifts. Like, I like, it's why I don't say fans very often. I say readers because I don't like the divide that the word fans creates. You know, I'm probably sounding very sappy right now, but the feeling that I have with my readers is that I say to them, oh, hey, Kate, I've got a story you want to hear. And they go, yeah. And I go, okay, cool, sit down. And then we're just two people and I tell them a story. And that relationship makes me happy. And I think, given that we have no idea if any marketing works anyway, you may as well be happy.
You may as well be happy. I love that. I promised that our listeners that we would come back to talking about mediation. We have run out of time. I'm going to put a link into that fabulous episode where you talk about co-authoring disagreements and you talk about your mediation practice. And also, I'm just getting you to flag in your calendar that we are coming back to this and having another conversation about all the things that we didn't get to talk about.
Yes, please.
A couple of things before we finish. You are obviously asked all the time and you've given some brilliant advice already in this episode. If there's one piece of advice that you can give to writers who are coming up that elevator behind us, what's the best piece of writing advice that you always share, Amy?
Oh, gosh. You know, I used to have different answers to this. I used to say things like, just finish the book and, you know, so on and so forth. But I think because I've been working on this course, I've been really thinking about, for me, what makes for a happy writing life. And I think it's that you can't hate making movies and push your way through it just for that one glorious moment you get to stand on the red carpet in your fancy dress. And so you can't write books just for that one moment that you get to walk into a bookshop, which you may never get to do. And, you know, with any given book, this goes for me too, and see it on a shelf and be like, ah, yes, I've made it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. So my piece of advice would be to find a process that you love, to figure out what that is for you. And if it's slower than everyone else, that doesn't matter. If it is, sometimes I don't write and then sometimes I go away for a whole weekend and write a bazillion words, that's great too. If it's, I like to research or I don't, or what, it doesn't matter what it is, but look at your process and interrogate it and work out which parts of it make you happy, because not only do we do things that make us happy more, but also the process is most of the experience. So you really may as well be enjoying it. Life is too short.
Is way too short. Finally, Amy Kaufman, have you got a debut recommendation for us, any time, any genre?
Mm-hmm. I knew this question was coming, and Kate can see my face and no one else can, like the number of recommendations that want to burst out of my face right now.
You can have more than one if you would like.
Well, the one I'm going to recommend is Nightbirds by Kate J. Armstrong, who is my co-host on Pub Dates. I am just wild about this book. I am just wild about it. You know when one of your friends writes something and they give it to you and you look at them with new eyes and go, oh, I didn't know you were that smart. It is exquisite. It's her debut novel, but it's certainly far from the first novel that she wrote. And boy, does it show. The writing is so rich and so accomplished. It is, think of the 1920s. Think of a fantasy city. Think of prohibition, but it's not on booze. It's on magic.
Oh,
yeah. And now imagine that there are three girls, the Nightbirds, who have a very special sort of intrinsic magic, the kind that can help you know what's going to happen in the next 10 minutes or help you look like someone else for a few minutes, and that they will gift it to you for a kiss in exchange for a secret. And then imagine that these girls, the Nightbirds, begin to realize that although they feel very powerful, it's possible that actually they're inside a cage. It is such a glorious book. It's full of beautiful dresses and beautiful locations, and it's about incredible, powerful girls who, you know, came to drink magical cocktails and overthrow the patriarchy, and they finished their cocktails. So
I literally adding to list right now, Nightbirds, fantastic, amazing recommendation. And Amy Kaufman, I'm going to say I wasn't having the best day today. I was looking forward to talking to you, but I feel so much better about the world right now.
That makes me so happy, Kate.
After speaking with you, thank you so much. You have been frank and you have been generous and you have just gifted us so much knowledge about the writing world and the writing practice. And thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.